Call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Couple housekeeping things. Welcome back. We haven't met, I believe, since May, since we went home. And first, a reminder to everybody that's in the room, turn your cell phones off. If it rings, you're going to have a hard time getting anything in the Senate tax bill this year. So, same thing for committee members. I just shut mine off. So, and then I would like to welcome back Michelle Allen, Senate counsel, who has been out on maternity leave and is now back with us. So, Michelle, welcome back to the tax committee. And members, anything you want to, housekeeping you want to bring up before we get started? Senator Johnson, good summer.
Mr. Chairman, I like your new look.
Longer, more hair?
Less hair on your face.
Less hair on the face, more on top. And cheeks are sucked in a little more. I've been working on that.
Okay, good.
My wife's been helping. Let's get started on the budget forecast. We've got Commissioner Hansen and Mr. Showalter and Dr. Stinson here.
Do they have the handouts? Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of the Department of Management and Budget, and I believe you have our slides in front of you. We're going to give a three-part presentation, just a brief summary by myself. Dr. Stinson will talk about the economic piece of the forecast, and Assistant Commissioner Showalter will talk about expenditures. I just want to direct you to the slide at the bottom of page one to tell you how we get to 1.203. The 2009 closing, Mr. Chairman, at the end of 2008-09, we carried forward $91 million less than we thought we would into this biennium. So that's $91 million that's not available that we thought would be. And that is a net number. Tax reduction was greater than that, but we actually picked up some spending savings. So it netted out at $91 million. You will see when Dr. Stinson talks that the real story here is the drop in revenue, 1.156. Most of that is income tax. 70% of the overall budget deficit is related to higher unemployment and wage decline. And then we actually picked up a savings of $44 million, so it nets out at 1.203. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson. You can turn to the beginning of the second page.
Dr. Stinson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. As the Commissioner said, the revenues for 2010-2011 are now projected to be 1.156 billion less than we forecast in February after adjusting for the governor's executive actions. That's a 3.7% decline in revenues. 70% of the revenues decline came through the income tax, and about 30% of it came in other taxes. The corporate tax and the sales tax receipts were roughly offsetting and relatively small. If you look at the details a little bit, the decline in income tax is actually a little bit more, and the other revenues is a little bit less. Prior to the expiration or elimination of the reciprocity, reciprocity was treated as a separate line in other revenues. Now the withholding that we will get from Wisconsin residents who are working in Minnesota is counted as part of withholding and counted as part of the income tax. So that a little bit more than $100 million is taken out of other revenues and added to income tax revenues. Without it, income tax revenues would have been less, even more, or even smaller than we had. The same way sales tax compliance, I'm sorry, overall tax compliance was a separate line in other revenues, and now it's part of the particular taxes. And so when you put this all together, you end up with about $1 billion decline in in revenues.
So to that reciprocity question, Dr. Stinson, so the $827 million that income tax collections are down, that number really would be $100 million worse if it was not for the Wisconsin reciprocity. So rather than a 70% income tax problem, it actually is larger than 70%?
Yes. And the other revenue, the decline in other revenues would be offset by a smaller amount, so that instead of having other revenues down $351 million, other revenues would be down $251 million. In the same way with respect to compliance, there's $45 million or something like that in compliance. Some of that goes to the income tax, and so we took the money off the compliance line, spread it to among income tax, sales tax, and corporate tax, so it lifted those three slightly.
So the income tax problems are actually something over $900 million?
Probably closer to a billion.
Most of the problem?
Almost all of the problem. The sales tax actually would have been positive except for a change in the sales tax refund estimates. And corporate tax already is positive, so there was also $100 million, a little bit more than $100 million of special dedicated revenues that were taken out of the general fund, along with $100 million, a little bit more than $100 million of dedicated expenditures from special dedicated revenues. They were both moved into special funds as opposed to, and not in the general fund, so that reduced both revenues and expenditures in the general fund by $104 million roughly. And so, again, this is almost entirely an income tax decline. The reason why...
Dr. Stinson, Senator Scheid.
I'm sorry to interrupt you here. I just wondered if you could compare where the corporate revenues were, corporate tax revenues were in the last couple of years. Is this consistent? Have they been a positive number? Or was that kind of turning around?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, no, the corporate tax has not been a positive number. In fact, if you look at the corporate tax receipts compared to 2008-2009 or 2006-2007, either one of them, the expectations are that in 2010-2011 we're going to receive less in corporate income tax than we did in either of those biennium. It's just that compared to what we thought in February, it's better.
Senator Scheid, there's a chart in the packet on the corporate tax collections, the close of the last biennium, and then the 10-11 forecast, and then the planning estimate. You can see in 10 and 11, it's a big problem. It's a $500 million piece of our budget deficit. Dr. Stinson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the question obviously everybody has is why are income taxes so low compared to forecast? And the answer is the economy, but it's a particular facet of the economy, not just generally that the economy is underperformed. The economy, as measured by GDP, has actually performed just about as Global Insight thought it would last February. And what's happened is that there's been a change in some of the components, and some of the components haven't done as well. If you look at the graph on the bottom of page 3, you can see what the problem is. And the problem is that wages are much lower than expected. Now, wages are about 70% of our income tax base. And in this forecast, Global Insight had 0.4% decline in wages in 2009. Now they are forecasting 4.5% decline in wages. This is a very unusual situation. We really haven't seen actual declines in wages. We've seen wages not grow as fast as forecast, but we haven't seen declines where the level of wages received by everybody in the country. And again, it's important to understand this is total U.S. wages. This is the sum of all wages paid to everybody in the country over the last year has shrunk by more than 4.5%. If you turn to the next chart, and this is the chart that is titled Total Wage U.S. Wages Have Declined for Three Quarters. What you see is what's happened to U.S. wages looking back to 1970. You could actually extend this chart and go back to the 1950s and the late 1940s, and the picture would still look very much the same. It's only one quarter in there where wages have actually shrunk. Now, sometimes they've declined from positive rates, but they still were positive. Here, only one quarter where they actually fell. If you look, then the last three quarters are all below. They show a decline. The fourth quarter is expected to be a decline as well. We believe that this is going to happen nationally and especially in Minnesota because we see the withholding tax receipts every day, and withholding tax receipts in November and October were less than they were in the prior year. And so it's very consistent with another quarter of declining wages. You turn to the next page, you can see the change in Minnesota wages and the change in Minnesota employment. Again, this is total Minnesota wages. This isn't the average wage. This is the total amount of wages received in Minnesota that we would collect taxes on. If you look at the lighter colored bars, you can see that in 2009, we had a forecast of 1.4% decline in February. We now think that wages will decline by 5.5% in Minnesota. The difference between Global Insights' forecast of 4.5% for the U.S. and the Minnesota forecast that we make of 5.5% doesn't necessarily reflect the fact that Minnesota's economy could be weaker than the U.S. economy. Really, it's more a reflection of the fact that we have this withholding data that allows us to anticipate what's going on in the quarter better than national forecasters do who don't have the withholding data and are having to draw on other items.
Dr. Stinson, on this wage page where it shows a 5.5% decline in wages for 9, and then it shows wages actually going up by almost 2% in 10. Is I understand that the total aggregate wages that are earned in Minnesota are going to be down 5.5%. Some of that, a large piece of that, is the unemployment we're experiencing, so people aren't earning anything. But how much of it is kind of a correction in the overall wage structure in the economy? Are wages generally coming down? And then does that set kind of a new floor so that the 2% increase next year is actually from a lower base? Is that a good assumption?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you're right on a whole bunch of points, but let me try and provide a little bit more structure to this. Your first question is that 5.5%, you understand that some of that comes from lower employment in the state. Well, 4% of it, if you just look at the decline in employment in the state. We've lost 4% of our employment in the state. So if the only thing that happened was that people lost their jobs and there was no adjustment in hours worked or in average wage per hour, we would have seen a 4% decline. So the additional 1.5% is a combination of decline in the number of hours worked and the number of hours worked for overtime pay as well, and a decline in the average wage per hour worked. And so you know, 4% is due to just job loss, the other 1.5% due to a combination of fewer hours worked by those that are working and lower average wage per hour worked. Now, your second question is, does this set a new base and then we grow off of this new base? Yes, it does set a new base for total wages in the state. If you turn back two slides, you can see really what's going on to the slide that's titled "The Decline in U.S. Wages Has Been Much Greater Than Previously Forecast." Okay, we're down at the bottom of that curve, and then you see that it's growing roughly at the same pace as it was growing, was projected to grow before. It's just starting from a lower base. Okay, that is total wages. If you're thinking about what's happening to the wage per hour for individual workers, that may not have necessarily been cut back. It may have been that individual workers just got fewer hours, and so one of the ways that we can get an increase in wages and still not have an increase in employment is by the existing workforce working more hours, beginning to get more hours of work in there. And that's, of course, what's in the forecast for most of 2010, is that we are not going to add a lot of jobs. And in fact, we think we're going to lose a few more jobs over the year before we start to begin to add jobs. But we expect that more hours will be worked looking on in as well.
Well, you know, I asked that, Dr. Stinsman, because I'm sure I read something in the paper here a couple months ago that individuals that lose their job in a recession, that are forced into some kind of retraining or finding a new occupation, I'm pretty sure that it said it takes them, a large percentage of them, up to 20 years to get back to where they were previous to the recession. Is there any information or study anywhere about that issue?
I'm sure there are. I don't have any off the top of my head that I can tell you, but when people change employment, change career, they start off typically at a lower level because they're new entrants into the workforce in that career, and so they're starting at entry-level jobs in that career as opposed to the more experienced levels that they had before. And so it does take a while. Hopefully they do eventually recover, but it's a long, slow crawl back.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Stinson. I've been wondering, I'm as optimistic as the next person, but what makes you think that wages are going to go up again by such a significant amount according to the forecast that I see here?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, again, it's important to remember that we're talking about the total amount of wages paid to everybody in the economy, not the individual wage per hour that we're talking about. So we're not talking about somebody's wage going from $15 an hour to $17 an hour. We're talking about total wages going from $150 billion to $170 billion or something like that. And the reason why we think that wages are going to go up is that we think that the economy has turned around, that the economy is starting to grow again, and that as retailers begin to restock their shelves, that there's going to be increased demand for goods. Those goods can't come from inventories because inventories have been drawn down. about as far as they can be drawn down. And so what you have to have is you'll have to have increased output from manufacturing. That will require more people working more hours. First, what will happen is that the average work week will go up, but eventually you'll need to add people on to produce goods as well, and that's how this will all filter through. It's going to be a long, slow process, but we are, we believe, on the upturn in the economy, and that's just kind of how things grow. First, more hours, then some overtime, then more jobs, and then just keeps building from there.
Mr. Chair,
you're saying that the new hours come from a lack of inventory, and that the lack of inventory, the change in inventory is needed because people have income to buy things. That's the part I'm struggling with. If we don't have folks who have jobs, they don't have disposable income, or if they have fewer hours. So how do they come up with the money to demand the new inventory? I mean, maybe it's the chicken and the egg here. I'm trying to figure out what is it exactly that the economists think is going to fuel this uptick in the economy now.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think some of it is consumer confidence comes back. You know, people that have their jobs, kind of some of the fears that they're going to lose it subsides as the economy turns around. So those of us that have jobs, kind of that have been reduced our spending, probably spend a little more when we have a little additional confidence that our job is going to be safe. But Dr. Simpson?
Mr. Chairman, that's part of it. Part of it is just that if there's nothing on the shelves, you have to start restocking the shelves a little bit just to cover normal purchases, normal consumption. We had, for a while, consumer spending was declining, and that was what made this recession so difficult. Consumer spending is actually increasing now. It's not increasing at a normal rate, but it is increasing. So that means that every month more goods are being purchased than were being purchased in the month before. If you, for a while, you can absorb that by taking goods off the shelf. But eventually, if you're a store owner, you're going to have to put more goods on the shelf for people to buy, or else the shelves are going to be empty and they're not going to be able to buy anything from you. So that's really what's going on. We've gone through a situation where we've drawn down inventories and drawn down inventories and drawn down inventories, and we're now pretty much at the point where inventories are as lean as they can be. The cash for clunkers part of the stimulus package, for example, drew down auto inventories pretty substantially. The first-time home buyer's credit drew down some of the excess supply of housing. And so, you know, now we're at a point where we think we're going to see companies, auto manufacturers, builders, start to begin to add to their inventory a little bit, so they'll have the goods available for sale that are going to be demanded by individuals like Senator Bach, who's going to be more confident about the economy, hopefully in some period here before too long.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Sandra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, I'm sitting here wondering, as we think about the current deficit, $1.2 billion, 70 or so percent of that reflected in lost wages, would that picture be similar to other states around the country, or is Minnesota unique in any way in terms of this is the way we lost money, other states are losing money, revenue at least in different ways, or is this just the average picture?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjan, the loss in wages is a national loss in wages. I mean, 4%, 5%, whatever. So if you have an income tax and you're reliant on the income tax is going to be down and down substantially. Now, I heard on public radio yesterday a report from the state of Washington, an interview with the governor from the state of Washington, And state of Washington's an interesting example for me, partly because I'm from the state of Washington, but also because they don't have a state income tax. They're reliant on the sales tax for a substantial amount of their budget. They're a state that's roughly the size of Minnesota. They're also, they don't have a corporate income tax. They have a gross receipts tax. According to this report, they are reporting a $2 billion shortfall for the biennium. So even if you're reliant upon the sales tax, and you say from the state of Washington, that's a very, very broad-based sales tax. Even if you're reliant on the sales tax, because consumer spending has declined so much, it hasn't provided protection for the state of Washington, at least.
Interesting.
Let's continue.
Mr. Chair, I'll pick it up then. We'll go on to the spending side.
Mr. Showalter, your name.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. And we'll take a look at the next couple of slides. I walk through the other part of the budget, which is the spending side. Dr. Stinson has walked you through the revenue and the economic factors that led to the virtually a very, very large portion of the change in this forecast. On the spending side, the first slide you'll see is about 0.1% change in the spending. There are a number of different factors, largely offsetting, that go with that, slightly lower pupil costs, leading to slightly lower education spending, slightly increased tax aids and credits. The two major pieces here are Health and Human Services, which dropped by $109 million, and lower counterbalanced by lower debt service spending by $123 million. Starting with debt service, just very simply, I think we all know the interest rates right now are very low. That leads to lower borrowing costs, higher premiums that we receive when we do issue bonds. Also gave us some refinancing opportunities that Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell can talk about more at some other point if you're interested. Bottom line, debt service savings. On the general fund side, on the health care side, you're seeing really...
I'm having a little problem hearing both Dr. Stinson and Mr. Showalter. If you could bring that closer and or speak louder, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. The offsetting the debt service savings that I just mentioned is on Health and Human Services. A continuing set of links between the general fund and the Health Care Access Fund, wherein there's transfers going between these funds, and in this forecast there are some assumptions that are made on how those transfers will be played out based on current law, as well as the enrollment of people from General Assistance Medical Care, which does not have funding in 2011, and how that will impact the Minnesota Care enrollment, since these people are really eligible for both programs. So going on to the next slide, you'll see that there's three major factors built into this spending side forecast. The first one is the governor's unallotment and executive actions. These figures all build in the assumption that it's based upon the bills that were passed, along with line item vetoes at the end of session, along with the governor's unallotments and executive actions, so that's the point of comparison that you're looking at in these charts. We've tried to decompose that in some places so you understand what those impacts are, but that's the reference point that we have here. One of the major items, point number two, is General Assistance Medical Care. And there is a transfer in 2011 that's built into the spending side here that really drives that human services growth. $111 million transfer from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund to make sure that Minnesota Care has enough money to continue the estimated expenditures, the estimated obligations in that year.
Mr. Showalter, is that an automatic transfer? Is there anything the governor can do to stop that from happening?
Mr. Chair, that $111 million is basically a transfer that is only for 10 and 11. It's in statute that says that there will be a transfer made if Minnesota Care expenditures exceed resources. That would be an appropriation. That would be a transfer that would be could be changed by a budget initiative, by an allotment. It is really an interfund transfer.
So the governor could unallot that $111 million and force the health care access fund into bankruptcy?
Mr. Chair, if that transfer didn't occur, that would make the health care access fund go negative in fiscal 10 and 11. And yes, it wouldn't go into bankruptcy, but then you would have to assess what kind of options there are to balance that fund out.
Mr. Chairman, it would not be bankrupt. It would give the governor the ability to unallot in the health care access fund to bring revenues and expenditures into a line.
Does that mean, Commissioner, change eligibility or change reimbursements, or what would the governor's options be if he's going to bring down the spending in the health care access fund?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't really even gotten to that point, but anything that is spending in the health care access fund, that would be fair game.
So it's eligible, Mr. Chairman. Is that the
Senator Rest?
It's eligible for an allotment.
Yes.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, yes. And we haven't even, you know, looked at that to that extent yet.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think the point here is that the health care access fund was already finding its balances going down, that the enrollment in that fund and through the Minnesota Care Program was rising, that the cost per enrollee was rising. Now with 30,000 more enrollees from the General Assistance Medical Care, that puts that fund, which was already going negative by 2013, essentially in deficit in 2011, if not for that general fund transfer. So the problem and the costs of the health care programs are still baked into this forecast, and there's some assumptions here as to how we would try to deal with that.
But Mr. Showalter, so if the governor decides to unallot the transfer, does he kind of, what are his options then with the health care access fund that's in the red? Is he just not pay hospitals for services performed, or kind of what are his authorities, I guess? Does he pay them out as a percentage? Kind of what flexibility does the governor have?
Mr. Chairman, the unallotment power applies to every fund, but it's a fund specific. I mean, in the last year, we unallotted in the general fund. We have not unallotted in other funds. But the same, we would have to go through the same analysis, you know, as we would if we had as we did when we unallotted in the general fund. It's just that it would be in the health care access fund.
But Commissioner, my point is that the individuals are enrolled and they have coverage, and they're going to go and seek whatever medical services they need. The medical institution is going to assume they're going to get paid from the state, but if the fund is in the red, what options does the governor have then to make sure that the services that have been rendered actually are reimbursed if there's no money in the fund?
Mr. Chair, I think those options, we would have to look at those, but you know, like you would assume, it is eligibility, it is reimbursement rates, it is services covered. You know, all of those things would have to be reviewed and discussed in finding some way to balance that fund if that were to come to pass.
Well, that's kind of my question. Does the governor have that authority to reduce eligibility or say that certain parameters aren't going to be covered any longer under unallotment?
We're not restricted like we are in the medical assistance program by federal stimulus money. We can, if we chose to, reduce eligibility in Minnesota Care and the health care access fund and not run into any difficulties with federal maintenance of effort requirements. That would be an option.
And Commissioner, does the governor have that authority?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, the state basically says very clearly no funds may be paid from the state treasury without an appropriation, and that we can't overspend if that money isn't there. In this instance, we've set up a separate fund that's defined self-balancing, and that's what the unallotment authority speaks to, is that if a fund has been set up, it has to be supported on its own, doesn't have the ability to borrow, it doesn't have the ability to go find revenues in some other place. We have to find some way to balance it. And that's true for the general fund. That's always the context we've talked about it. But you'll see in past budgets, whether it's in the environment funds or other places, we've had to make recommendations to bring funds into balance. That would be true here in the health care access fund as well.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenthal, did I hear you say this $111 million transfer is for 2011 only. Now, if these individuals are auto-enrolled into the Minnesota Care, wouldn't that cost be ongoing in your forecast?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it would be. And so that's the interplay between current law and sort of the ongoing projections. The transfer authority between the general fund and the Health Care Access Fund is rather unique. And that really is only for 2010 and 11. Those enrollees, though, and are anticipated, at least some portion of them are anticipated to continue on that program into 2012 and 13, creating a sizable deficit in the Health Care Access Fund.
So, Mr. Chair, we had a declining balance in this fund, and we're adding these people that's going to make the balance decline faster.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Continue.
Mr. Chair, then the third point here on key factors affecting the forecast is the Federal Stimulus Act. That you've seen that impact on some of the economics, but it also affects the spending numbers that you're looking at here pretty significantly, receiving roughly $1.8 billion in federal matching funds through the Medicaid and Minnesota Care funds, as well as state stabilization funding of $816 million. That is received in fiscal years 9, 10, and 11. We are not anticipating or projecting continued receipt of those funds. General fund spending rises accordingly in 12 and 13.
If you turn to the next slide, Mr. Chairman and members, it titled Fiscal Year 12 and 13 Planning Outlook Worsens, you will see that our projections for fiscal years 12 and 13 increase from about $4.4 billion to $5.426. And at the bottom of the slide, I want to walk through what is and is not included, because there has been much debate. And our slide presentation, Mr. Chairman, as well as our documents contain these points as well. If you did include inflation, you would add another $1.1 billion. This 5.4 does include a complete repayment of the K-12 shift. If you recall, as part of the unallotment process, we deferred $1.2 billion. Is it too loud? $1.2 billion of the K-12 aid into the next biennium. That would be available to shift, and if that were the case, it would be 5.4 minus the 1.2. It does not include repayment of the K-12 property tax recognition shift of 562, and it does not include restoration of the GAMC program for $928 million.
So, Commissioner, what's the real number? What is the number that the next governor is going to face in a real budget deficit? He gets elected in November, January, he's got to submit a budget to the legislature. What's the deficit that individual he or her are going to have?
Mr. Chairman, our official number is 5.426. The reason we include these other numbers is because others have raised them as issues, and we want to make sure that all the numbers are there for debate.
And Commissioner, what percentage of the budget is that?
3.7? No.
That's the forecast change. Mr. Chair, that's basically $5.4 billion out of $30 billion, so about one-sixth.
One-sixth, about? We got a CPA here. What's the percentage, 16. Senator Rest? 16, about a 16% deficit the next governor will face?
Mr. Rainman here.
Dr. Stinson, what's the number?
14.2%.
14% budget deficit for the next biennium. That's below current spending. Is that correct?
Well, 14.2 of the overall total.
It's a mismatch between the revenues and the anticipated spending levels, Mr. Chairman.
Current revenues are expected to be about $30 billion. 2012-2013 revenues are expected to be $33 billion. So there's actually an increase of more than 12% in revenues over that time, but expenditures are expected to grow beyond that.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, when you say the planning estimates assume those three things, is that assumption based on no action necessary to be taken by the legislature and the governor in order to reach that point? We don't have to do anything. And if we don't do anything, like not meet next year, we're at 5.426 given current law and the current actions taken by the current governor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, correct.
And if we wanted to change any of those assumptions, the legislature would have to pass a bill. The legislature would have to pass something. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, in essence, is a menu of major decisions. It's a menu of some of the decision points we'll be looking at, I think.
But if we did nothing, if we did not complete repayment of the K-12 aid deferral, and we did not repay the K-12 property tax recognition shift, and we did not continue GAMC spending, we don't have to do anything to accomplish those three assumptions. Is that correct? Or we have to do something to do we have to pass a bill that says no continued GAMC spending? Does the legislature have to act, or if we just did nothing, those three things would happen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that's our understanding. Now, there has been some debate. I know some members of the House have expressed concern that an unallotment of the second year of GAMC, the entitlement is in statute, whether that carries forward into 12 and 13 or not. And that's one of the reasons why we have that here. We believe that the funding that for our forecast Cease. Assumptions that the funding is not there.
So not, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, so we're at 5.426 if we do nothing, and we're at 5.426 if the governor takes no further action.
That's correct.
14%, Senator Rest.
Yeah, I'm just want to make sure that we understand that if we want to change that number based on the assumptions in this planning estimate, the legislature has to act. Otherwise, if we wanted to delay repayment, we have to take action.
Right.
Otherwise, the repayment of the K-12 aid deferral is accomplished.
Right, and that would be
inside that 5.426.
Right. So then you would subtract 1.2. If you make permanent, if we choose to make permanent the governor's unallotments from this biennium, you add another billion, and you subtract the 1.2 and the, it's 2.2 off of 5.4, and the chairman's 14.2% becomes a little less.
And if we wanted to restore the GAMC spending, we would be adding approximately another billion to the deficit.
Correct.
If we took that action.
Yes.
And, Commissioner, all that assumes no inflation, that the costs of state government will not go up at all.
Mr. Chairman, we don't include inflation in the forecast. We assume that government just improves and gets better and we become more efficient in that.
So that assumes no increases for state employees, no increase in benefits to public employees. It assumes no additional matches for any federal money coming to the state, just no new money.
Well, it just assumes that if you choose to make those decisions, you prioritize and find the savings elsewhere.
But if the federal government passes some health and human service provisions that trigger a state match, is that inflation? And were you just ignoring that?
We factor in medical inflation. That's the one area, eligibility increases, and we factor that. That's the one piece of this budget that is on the
change. So there is an inflation provision in here for the health and human service area?
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, did I hear you say that the revenues in 2012-2013 are expected to go up by 12%? Is that what you said? And then that would take us to the $33 billion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Orton, if you compare the revenues projected for 2012-2013, which is $33.2 billion, with the revenues projected for 2010-2011, which is just about $30 billion, that's 12.5%. So that's what's built into the forecast, is an increase in revenues of about 12.5%.
Well, Senator Orton, I think the issue there is it's an increase in a lower base. If you look at this sheet that we have, it is not, we will not have recovered to receive the same amount of revenue, collect the same amount of revenue as we did in 2006. Will still be lower. Dr. Stinson, is that accurate?
I'm not sure about 2006. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if you have the numbers that say that, you're probably right.
Yeah. Members, this sheet here, I think, is helpful to see what the revenues have been back to 2006. Senator Ortman.
But, Mr. Chair, I think what he's saying is, based on what our actuals will be in this biennium, we're projecting an increase from the actuals in this biennium to the next biennium. We'll have more than we actually have in this biennium by 12%, and that assumes all of the positive economic forecast and the growth that we've been talking about. That's correct?
That's right.
Thank you.
As long as you don't let any
go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then just the final.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Stinson.
On page 76 of the forecast book, it's pointed out to me that we have actual revenues for 2006 and 2007. And they total out to be a little bit more than $32 billion, about $32.3 billion. And we're forecasting $33.2 for 2012-2013, so they wouldn't be less than 2006-2007 and 2012-2013. In 2010-2011, they're less than 2006-2007. But not in 2012-2013.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, do the stimulus monies get counted in the revenue numbers that you're talking about now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, the stimulus monies you're talking about are like the FMAP money and things like that, and the stimulus aid that comes in. Is that the stimulus
yeah,
money you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, what I'm thinking about is at the end of session last year when they were doing the budget, there was some $1, $2 billion worth of federal stimulus money that we were using to help balance the budget. Are they counted in this $30 billion that you're talking about as the 10 and 11 revenues number?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scott, no, they're not. The treatment of the stimulus money is that it reduces expenditures. It is the revenues are actual money that is collected from Minnesota taxpayers.
So really that increase that it appears like we had in, dollars to spend on services isn't really there because it's being offset by the federal stimulus money that we had that we aren't getting again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, if I may just add, in the forecast document itself on page 50, we provide some detail on the presence of some of those stimulus dollars, how they affect the spending side of the budget, holding down the 10 and 11 numbers, how they are counted and treated in 12 and 13. So we got a couple of graphics and a brief explanation of that in the document.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, but in essence we have $2.579 billion of spending in the current biennium that we're doing, and then the federal money goes away in the next biennium. So we have support. It's $2.5 billion of our solution in the current two-year biennium that doesn't appear there. It's one time. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, the last chart is just an overall summary of aggregate revenues and spending. Gives you a complete picture of the $1.203 billion deficit. And with that, we're available for your questions. But that concludes our presentation.
Any other questions, members? Any good news, Commissioner?
You get to hear me again in a minute. That's good news.
You going to come with another good idea?
Yes.
Dr. Stinson, Mr. Showalter, thank you.
Thank you.
Have a nice holidays. Members, the second thing that we put on the agenda for today was back on November 5th. The governor had a press conference and promoted the idea of a constitutional amendment to limit, as I understand it, spending in the current biennium to whatever revenue was collected in the previous one. And I was intrigued by the idea, and so I wrote him a letter the next day and asked him if he would like to himself or send somebody to the tax committee today. We had scheduled this hearing and indicated we'd like to learn more about the idea. All I have seen to date is a press conference and a press release, so I don't really know anything more about it than that. But so we're looking to learn more about that. First, I have Commissioner Hansen and maybe Senator Koch. Senator Koch, welcome to the Senate Tax Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Is it morning? Yes, still morning. Members, nice to see you. I just received some very sobering news. Well, hearing a lot of sobering news today with the budget. And so we come to you today with an idea.
That's it? Okay, go ahead, Senator Koch.
Okay. Senator Bach, members of the Senate Tax Committee, thank you for the special opportunity you have given us today to speak about Governor Pawlenty's proposal, a bill to ask the voters of the great state of Minnesota to help take control of decades of unsustainable growth and to constitutionally limit non-emergency state spending. This measure, if approved by the legislature, would allow Minnesotans next November to vote on the constitutional ballot question. The question reads, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to require that state government general fund expenditures be limited to the amount of actual general fund revenues received by the state in the previous two-year budget? Or, in more simple terms, should government be held within its means? From 1960 to 2003, many of us have heard, Minnesota's two-year state budgets increased by an average of more than 20%. Had the amendment been in place in 1960, general fund spending since then would have been reduced by about $22 billion or 7.5% since 1960. We have experienced instead growth that is unsustainable, and it is also unfair to Minnesota's hardworking taxpayers who are the source of the state's bank account. Last week and today, we received another dose of bad news from the state economist that fewer Minnesotans working is translating into worse than expected budget deficits. And we will be forced to trim another $1.2 billion out of the current budget. Had we practiced spending restraint, setting priorities, and keeping closer to our means, we would be in a more comfortable fiscal position today. Mr. Chairman, I would like to address some of the facts about this proposal and some of the misconceptions. Some of its opponents have already tried to compare it to the tax limitation measures in other states. Many states have gone down the path of placing fiscal guardrails. In fact, we are in the minority. About 30 states currently have either taxing or spending limits. 18 of them have it in the Constitution, and 12 of them have it statutorily. In fact, neighboring states, Iowa and Wisconsin, both have limits. This proposal would not be as complex as many of those. This is a simple one-time change that would provide a common-sense guideline for the legislature. If you don't have the money, you don't spend it. Other folks say that the plan is too restrictive and has been other constitutional amendments that we've had. But again, I think they overcomplicate the issue. We're not, you know, putting this money into different pots, into different areas. It simply sets up some guardrails and spending limits. It will retain flexibility to debate within those limits the priorities of education, environment, public safety. We will also ensure that the proposal allows us to meet our needs during extraordinary crisis. It is restrictive only in that it turns down the volume of special interests at the Capitol and returns a degree of control back to those who pay the bills, Minnesota taxpayers. I thank you again for this opportunity to speak, Senator Bach. I think that was very kind and appreciate your attention.
Thank you. Senator Cook, one of the, this is the first I've seen the language today, I guess. I'm just wondering, the savings that you're reporting that the state could have saved, the $22 billion, wouldn't it be, those are not inflation-adjusted dollars. I mean, wouldn't it be fair in this language to somehow include some kind of inflation or some recognition for population growth? I mean, there are a lot of additional people in Minnesota than there were 40 years ago. And, I mean, there is some cost in providing state services to a larger population. Isn't there kind of something missing in here that recognizes kind of some of the changing things that are happening in the state? I'm just wondering, I look at the sheet about how much the budgetary increases were under previous governors, and I can't help but see Harold Lavander in 71, a 46% increase. And that, I believe, members, was attributable to the fact that they did the Minnesota Miracle and they changed the way we funded schools. Mm-hmm. So there was a significant reduction in property taxes, even though it looked like there was additional burden put on the general fund. I'm just wondering if by putting this in the Constitution you don't reduce the flexibility available for future legislatures to maybe do a major reform where we can buy down property taxes and move some burdens to the general fund. Or do we just, with this, just let property taxes run out of control because the state doesn't have any flexibility to address the property tax problem? Have you thought about that?
And absolutely, Senator Bach. First, a couple things to address. Other states in their tax and spending limits do have different formulas, and we've got some folks here that can address other more complicated formulas. The idea here was to keep this fairly simple. This is not preclude any tax increases. What it would do is delay that some. You would be basing on looking a 2-year look back, and so a legislature would be really we'd have to be looking forward and looking to other spending needs. But you wouldn't have the tax hikes that you would do now would not affect the spending. They'd move on, and of course there'd be automatic growth. I mean, not automatic, but there's often growth. Natural growth in the budget, so it wouldn't be that it's just a total complete cap, but there will be years like this year where there's reduction. I mean, and Mr. Hansen can explain it better, but I think what this does is sort of it brings a little bit of evenness to it without being entirely restrictive. That's why I like it. I think some of those other formulaic proposals and other things that states do can be a little more restrictive. And so I think the idea here was to keep it fairly simple.
Well, I'm just wondering, Senator Cook, if it doesn't just preclude doing reforms because the legislature has no ability to change its general fund spending. For example, I think one of the biggest shortcomings of the governor is his strategy for school funding, where if a district can pass a voter-approved levy, well, they can get money per pupil. But if a district cannot, they aren't able to get more per pupil funding in their school. And I actually have a couple of districts in my Senate district that do not have an excess operating levy, and they fail for a number of reasons. But so I think we're getting a lot of disparities in school funding. But doesn't something like this preclude the legislature being able to reform a process like that and move away from property taxes and move more towards general fund spending for schools? I mean, how would I reform that? If I don't like those voter-approved levies and I say, you know what, we're like we did in 2000, was it 2001 we did the 415 roll-in? where we took the first $415 of excess levies and we rolled it, that obligation over to the general fund. Wouldn't this totally preclude the legislature an opportunity to reduce property taxes because our general fund spending is restricted? Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, this amendment would not in any way, shape, or form eliminate the ability to reform. What it does is it requires us to prioritize. And you can spend what to that level that was spent in the previous biennium. Anything above that is one-time money. So we're building so that that revenue up on the, you know, at the top, the fringe that we collect that always seems to go up and down with the forecasts we talk about, is what we're trying to base one-time spending on. Tax cuts, those type of things. Any reforms you want to do, I mean, we would have to prioritize anyway. Anything you want to do, we can't just increase spending $2, $3, $4 billion. You're going to have to offset it. You're going to have to make the same choices that you would whether this was in law or not.
But, Commissioner, in 2001, we did increase state spending significantly when we did the school takeover, and we took the gen ed levy off of homes, and we shifted that obligation to the state's general fund. We decided that education should be paid for by the state, not by property taxes. And now, doesn't this preclude us? I mean, don't we get our hands tied so that we can never revisit those kind of decisions?
I think you would just delay. You would just delay it till the next biennium, because that would be one method or one tool you could use to meet your objectives.
But I think my point is, Commissioner, under this, we could have never done that. We could not have reduced property taxes and shifted school funding to the general fund because we wouldn't have had the capacity.
There would have been a way if it had been, and it was important enough, Mr. Chairman. I think you would just delay it into the next biennium, and so it still would have been accomplished.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cope, and to the governor's office, I'm glad that you've brought something forward. I'm not sure if this is the answer. I'm always concerned about proposing a change to the Constitution. I just like it kind of the way it is. But I wonder two things. What you're saying is raise the money in advance for your programs. If you want to, you know, increase education spending, great. Raise the tax first. Pass it. Then make sure in the next biennium you're going to have the money to spend on your priorities. I think that's what this at least seems to accomplish. But I'm wondering about the application in 2012-2013 based on what we heard. Would the application be that we would have to come up with a budget at the $30 billion level because that's what our actual revenues are in 2010-11, and then somehow we would have to reform our spending, which is now projected for 2012-13 to be $38 billion? Would we have to is that what is being proposed, that we would have to somehow come back with our 2012-2013 budget and cut $8.6 billion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I think we have to work on the timing. Has to get on the ballot, has to pass, and then has to be made. We haven't gotten to that level of detail on the actual language, but it would be. Under this application, it would be based on the revenue we spent in this biennium.
Well, sir, I put this on the agenda because I think it's a discussion this committee needs to have. Upstairs there's 10 spending committees. They're all spending money, and they rely on this committee to try and raise it. And so I think we have to have a discussion in this room about what I'm concerned about is a new normal where we have an economy that settles in after this recession where for some period of time we are going to have lower revenues as this economy kind of adjusts. And so, I think this is an important discussion. And Senator Koch, once the bill gets introduced, I have some interest. I don't know if the committee members do, to maybe have another hearing on it. Is there something here we can work with to actually get something meaningful on the ballot? I don't know yet. I mean, the first thing that kind of came to mind when I heard the governor talk about it was, well, how would I ever pay back the school shift? We have that now. How would I do that? And my first perception also was, is the legislature just going to let property taxes just run wild because our general fund spending is so restricted. So I think there's some things we need to think about, and I'd like the committee members to think about it between now and when we hear it again, and maybe, Commissioner, if the governor can think about that also.
Sure. Mr. Chairman,
I think let's all admit it. We have some big challenges, not only the $1.2 billion in this biennium, but going forward, the 5.4 problem. This is not going to be business as usual in Minnesota. And so I think it's a reasonable discussion for us to have.
Thanks, sir.
Commissioner?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, you're asking good questions, and right. If you're willing to work with us, we'd love to work with you and add you as a co-author on the amendment.
Bring the bill by, Commissioner.
That's right.
Sends a pretty strong message when the chair signs on as an author, doesn't it?
Yes, it is.
Senator Ortman, Jefferson. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hansen, one of the things when you're drafting the language, I think you're going to need to think about, and as I was listening to Senator Ortman talk about, you know, you're going to collect the taxes now, and then 2 years later, you're going to have to, you could have the ability to spend them because your general fund revenues would be up. But, I've served on a lot of different local governments before I was here, and one of the things that was always frustrating to me was the amount of money that was just kind of held in reserve for rainy day stuff. I always thought that if you're going to collect the taxpayers' money, you should put it to work. And if you're going to collect the tax now and then hold it for 2 years before you can do the property tax reform that Senator Bach is talking about, seems like it's not a very efficient use of your dollars, because those dollars are going to be collected and just sitting there. And so you're going to want to really think about how that timing issue is going to work, because that seems really inefficient.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, we would use, that's what we talked about, is these one-time, use it for one-time purposes, and then, in the next biennium it could be used for ongoing purposes.
Correct.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Skoy.
Commissioner Hansen, that isn't what it says here. It says that your expenditures are going to be limited to the amount in your general fund revenues. It doesn't say that you can use them for one-time expenditures and then use them for ongoing expenditures after a two-year time period. It says that you're limited. So I don't see how you could use those dollars for one time. It limits your expenditures.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, anything collected above the previous biennium spending could be used for one-time purposes.
Well, that isn't. We'll have that. That language appears
we'll
to me that has to be worked
exactly.
on.
Anything else, Commissioner? Anything further?
Well, just a couple of points. I know there are other testifiers. I did want to emphasize 30, as Senator Koch said, 30 other states. This is not a radical concept, Mr. Chair. Massachusetts has this. There are 30. We are, one of the 20 outlier states that don't have guardrails. But a couple of the good, sound financial practices that this amendment would lead to are also emphasized in the bipartisan Budget Trend Study Commission from this past January. And one is the state, and they said in that report, the state should begin by spending no more in the current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. And that's one of the concepts I talked about. And then second, any additional one-time revenue should be used for building reserves, paying off shifts, capital and, projects, and other one-time purposes. That's all I had, Mr. Chair. I know there are other testifiers.
Senator Sindrum, you have something now? Or?
Well, maybe just a general comment, Mr. Chair. And that is, first of all, I thank Senator Koch for bringing this forward. And I think there's a lot of common sense to this. And, as you look at the summary sheet here for the last 40 years or so, it's rather, I think, hard to defend, although, frankly, every legislature over the course of that 40 years defended it because they voted it, and that's the spending. But as we think about where we are today in history, that is not sustainable. Whether or not this legislature or future legislatures have the discipline to, if you will, live within the means, I don't know. But I think this takes us to that idea. And we have to live within the revenue stream of the state of Minnesota. I don't think, personally, and we can get into this, we're not going to tax our way to prosperity. I've said that 100 times, perhaps, at this committee. We've got to let business reign, business flow, And we have to let our wealth come from, if in fact, the private sector job community. And I happened to pull out, Mr. Chair, where is it? I don't know why I found this, but I've got a lot of stuff at home. The 2007 Minnesota Business Barometer put together by the Minnesota Chamber. And first and foremost on their conclusions is high taxes are viewed as the biggest barrier to creating more jobs in Minnesota. So we have to look at this, and again, whether or not we have the discipline as a legislature to live within our means, historically I think the answer is no. And I think we've got to look at this kind of amendment, work the language out if we need to, but I think this is a good start towards a good debate that needs to occur.
Well, Senator Sensenbrenner, that's why I scheduled it. Yeah. I mean, I think some discussions about recognizing population growth, I mean, I think there's some other factors that need to be considered if we're going to do something. But and I do expect we're going to spend more time on this. Yep. Senator Colt?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'd just like to just touch on quickly the issue of the constitutional amendment versus statutory language, because I also had some concerns about, changing the Constitution. We don't do that lightly. One, I would just say that it is the people's money, so, that they would put some limits on how we spend it seems somewhat reasonable, and we are not putting this into specific pots. We're not saying you must spend this much on education, this much on public safety. There's none of that. And then finally, I did talk to some folks, and they're going to be testifying in a later. We talked about constitutional amendment versus statutory, and the states that have it constitutional tend to be doing better fiscally. For example, California has limits, but they have it in statute. And then we know the story of California. So just some, because I think that is another good piece of the discussion. Do we do it, if we would do something like this, should we do it in law or would we do it in the Constitution? So just another answer.
Senator Colk, I share your concerns about amending the Constitution, because what we do is we really bind future legislatures. And, I mean, I just think of what is it that we don't know today that the legislative body is going to know 20 years from now that they're going to want to respond to. And for me personally, I think about when I came here in 1994, I don't believe we even had an early childhood committee in the Senate. And we didn't have any spending, categorical spending for early childhood. And as a result of research done at the University of Minnesota, I mean, we've learned the incredible brain development that happens in those first 3 or 4 years of life, and the legislature, as a result of all that university research, decided, hey, it would be a good investment for the state to invest in early childhood, and we did that. And what concerns me, and I think it concerns most of us, is what is it that 15, 20 years from now the legislature is going to know how public priorities change, and just to be careful that we don't make decisions today that, so that they can't respond to changing priorities.
And Mr. Chair, I do appreciate that. But, again, we're not trying to dictate any priorities here. The priorities of future legislature, the priority of our existing legislature wouldn't change within this. There would just be, just again, we use the guardrails idea. So we're not dictating priorities here. We're not attempting to do
Commissioner, that. How about open and standing appropriations, things like fire suppression? We've got a few of them in the budget. How do emergencies fit into this? Let's say we have a major flood and we have to have a special session. Is there some flexibility in, I mean, I don't see it in the language right now, but is there some flexibility built in to respond to catastrophes?
Yes. The governor's proposal, Mr. Chairman, would have an exception for natural disasters and emergencies.
Commissioner, do you have some other language that I haven't seen yet?
We haven't, as I said, put it. I'm basing my comments on his comments at his press conference and his press release.
Because, I mean, should we experience, pick a number, 10 years, 30 years, major epidemic?
Yes, you would have to include an exemption for that.
Yes.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think the guardrail that we currently have, that we have with that, but there may be some place between that and this proposed constitutional amendment that we have to go. But I really want to see, and I don't know the answer, and I may not like the answer, but I'd like to see what that spending, for example, under Governor Levander or Governor Wendell Anderson, what that was about, what the transfer was, what the trade-off was. Because we talk a lot about the increase in spending, And governors recently have talked a lot about that, but in some cases it's taking burden off one tax and saying the state's going to, you know, take care of that, we're going to take it off the property tax. I mean, I think we really need some truth in spending, if you will, here. We apparently have proof in taxation, but I think we need to get out there what our tax expenditures, for example. And I'm just looking at a book of tax expenditures. Well, it's very enlightening, but some of our growth in spending has been tax relief, a major part of it, actually, and particularly with school aid transfer to the state, which we sure didn't do a very good job of. I can't imagine how we'd ever accomplish it with the minimum of this place, but could be somebody do that?
You know, Senator Scheid, I've just kind of been thinking, what would preclude a future legislature from just raising fees or, frankly, raising taxes and calling it something else, a surcharge or something, and putting it in a dedicated account instead of into the state's general fund, and then just appropriating it out of that dedicated account? Commissioner, any thought? I mean, if we're going to do this, let's not leave such a big hole that you can drive a semi through.
We could apply it to the other funds as well.
Correct. Mr. Chair, we don't apply that currently. We apply it only to general fund. But
so does it really mean anything if you give the legislature or a future governor this big off-ramp where you can just create dedicated accounts and call something a surcharge, and it doesn't go into the general fund, it goes into a dedicated account that it's then appropriated out of? I just think this still needs some work.
I appreciate that.
Commissioner, what do you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your attitude. We're willing to work on it with you. You know, we started the concept with the general fund because that's the biggest fund we have. You know, you look at the other funds, the Trunk Highway Fund and the Healthcare Access Fund, I think have some guardrails around them already, but we would be willing to expand this amendment to those areas as well. I mean, but I do think that, I mean, it's a lot like, and as I was thinking of an analogy driving on my way in, it's a lot like, when I want to lose weight, and I'm not always never successful at it, but when I do, I have a diet. I have a framework and a plan, and that's what this is. It's a diet for state government over a period of time for it to manage and control its spending and its decisions.
Any other questions of Senator Koch or the commissioner? Commissioner, one thing before you leave, and I probably should have asked this earlier. What is, because this relates to the budget, what is the situation with the state's cash flow right now? I mean, I read stuff in the paper that we're delaying, and I think Commissioner Ines called me and said we had delayed some corporate tax refunds just to make sure the state had the money to pay its bills. Where are we currently at from a cash flow standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, when we had, it was a hearing about a month ago now with the legislative subcommittee of that LCPFP, and I talked about how going into this next year, we would be getting in March, April, and May close to zero, a little closer than I would feel comfortable with. I still think we'll probably be okay. The revenue reductions that we talked about today are mostly 2011. But I would like to work with the legislature, and it requires us working with the LAC, to just set up a short-term borrowing mechanism just in case.
For cash flow?
Yeah, borrowing for cash flow.
Commissioner, didn't they do that in the 81-82 recession and the state's bond rating was badly damaged?
They did, but Mr. Chairman, they did it over the whole year. And as we've talked about this with the ratings agencies, and if we plan it and we're thoughtful about it and it is a short, and we're just talking about a month or two maybe in March and April, that's a better way to do it than to use that as a full year of cash flow.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner. I saw a graph a couple weeks ago about, I don't remember who prepared them.
And Mr. Showalter left with it here.
Yeah, but they showed this year there was a few months where we were close to zero, but in the following year, my recollection was close to half of the months had us down around that zero. And I think one of the assumptions that was on that sheet was when you got below 500 million, you had to start considering borrowing, and I think every month was below that number, or most of them. So how is this short-term borrowing mechanism, would it work when, you know, so many of the months are going to be in that situation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Squay, you have a great memory. You must have been on that subcommittee. We usually, in November and March, April, and May, are the typical months that we get lower. In November, and it was a week ago Monday, a week ago today, we paid our debt service payment. And so that's one of the biggest payments we make. And that is why we slowed the payment or delayed the payment of the corporate and the sales tax, which we should have started. You can check with Commissioner Innes, but the sales tax should be being paid now and the corporate here in a few days. So we're going to start those again because we're receiving some other payments. So it does get a little worse in 2011, and we're in the process of taking this forecast and all the expenditures and revenues down to a daily basis to see what that looks like. But it's going to be a little more problematic in 2011, as you remember.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner,
Senator Squay,
it really is a pretty bad sign for the state's fiscal order that we've come to this. And I understand that the whole nation's struggling through this economic downturn, but you know, we knew things were not going to be good even a year ago, and I would hope that we do a better, you know, as the legislature and everybody does a better job of planning for the future than we have in the past.
Thank you, Senator.
Anything else, members? Commissioner, Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
We need to keep the testimony to about 5 minutes per individual so that we can get out of here on time. We're going to start with Commissioner McDonough from Ramsey County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner and current president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Association of Minnesota Counties strongly opposed the adoption of Governor Plenty's constitutional amendment proposal. Counties believe that the proposal reduces flexibility in state budgeting and makes policymakers less accountable for their decisions. It is the position of AMC that elected officials, including the legislature and the governor, are responsible for enacting responsible and sustainable budgets. Just as local elected officials are charged with balancing the demands for public service with the ability to raise revenue. The proposed constitutional amendment is a simplistic response for dealing with the complexities of Minnesota's state budgeting process. Public budgeting is an art of finding an appropriate balance between the revenues and expenditures and resources and needs. Artificially limiting either side of the equation distorts the budgeting process and leaves the state without the ability to make economic and social changes. The governor's proposal would reduce the ability and agility of the state to respond to the ever more quickly changing world we live in. It is our belief that government flexibility in both revenue and expenditure decisions is a good thing. As we have seen over the last 10 years, what happens in the previous 2 years has not been a good indicator for future revenues or expenditures. The governor's proposal would make policymakers less accountable to voters for budget decisions. The governor's proposal would do nothing to address the inability of the legislature and the governor to reach agreement on a sustainable, fiscally responsible budget for the state of Minnesota. And if you have any questions, I think it's pretty clear where AMC stands on this one.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. Questions, members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Let me start by saying that I don't want to violate one of my principles, and that is about testifying on a bill without having language in front of me. And some of the things that were said by Senator Koch give me pause to understand the details of the proposal. So I would like to reserve some time to look at the actual language when the bill is introduced so that I can come back to the committee and share with you a more full understanding from our perspective on the bill.
Well, Mr. Carlson, I think Senator Bach indicated that when we had language, right, we would very likely have a hearing on the bill.
If I could just share a couple thoughts with you, though, with that in mind. And one of the things that comes to my mind is that cities in the state and counties as well are confronted with not quite a similar restriction, but we do have levy limits on our operations. And one of the things that Senator Bach was getting at was in my mind, the law of unintended consequences. And one of the things that I would urge you to carefully study when you look at any proposals like this is what kinds of perverse incentives might we create for state lawmakers. At the local level, when we deal with levy limits, we create incentives to borrow rather than use current resources. We create incentives we create disincentives to cut taxes, to be very honest with you. Levy limits create almost a stimulus for maintaining your property taxes at a higher level. And I think also under this proposal, as I see it released under the governor's press release, it seems as if there are some accommodations for special circumstances, for economic upheaval or for public safety threats or emergencies that might occur. Those, in my mind, are very similar to the special levies that are given to cities and counties under the levy limit law. And one of the things that we find very troubling is when we try to explain to taxpayers that those are deemed to be higher and better uses and therefore outside of the levy limits, that we can raise those levies without any sort of restriction. And that does create consternation among some of our taxpayers. Just some quick examples, though, of ways that unintended consequences could affect your budget just as they affect local government budgets as we deal with levy limits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Nan Madden from the Council of Nonprofits.
Thank you, Senator Bach and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nan Madden, Director of the Minnesota Budget Project at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We are concerned that the proposed constitutional amendment would create long-term funding challenges for services that our businesses, families, children, seniors, and citizens with disabilities rely on. It would radically shift Minnesota away from our tradition of representative democracy and make government less responsive to citizens and reduce accountability from our elected leaders. We think this spending limit amendment is an extreme and inflexible tool that takes decision-making power out of the hands of the people and their representatives. Public investments in education, healthcare, workforce development, transportation, and services for seniors and people with disabilities help build our state's infrastructure and quality of life. Under this amendment, the legislature and governor will be powerless to maintain adequate funding for these services and invest in the future needs of our state. As a result, this amendment will make it harder to give businesses the tools they need to prosper and limit opportunities for our families and workers. This constitutional amendment also tears down the foundations of our representative democracy. Minnesota has a proud tradition of strong civic engagement, including high rates of voter participation and engaging in other forms of political participation. In response to a lot of ways of receiving input, elected representatives must constantly weigh public expectations for things such as a quality education system, uncongested roads, and safe and healthy communities against concerns about the level of taxation. This amendment circumvents the public discussion by claiming there is a magic formula. In reality, there's no magic solution to balance the competing demands voiced by the public. Instead, as a community, we are constantly adjusting the balance as the issues and circumstances facing our state change. This amendment would hand this essential decision over to an inflexible formula instead of permitting a meaningful public debate. We also think this constitutional amendment undermines accountability, as mentioned by the other testifiers. Right now, we hold our public officials responsible for their budget decisions, but this amendment would blur those lines of accountability and forfeit the authority to determine the size of the budget to a formula. We also think this constitutional amendment is unnecessary to achieve its stated purpose. In his press statement describing the constitutional amendment, Governor Pawlenty describes his success in slowing government spending and cutting spending for the first time in the state's history. That outcome demonstrates that this amendment is not necessary. The governor has succeeded in achieving his desired outcome without this amendment, and other governors and legislatures can do the same. It is not appropriate, however, to require all future governors and legislatures to achieve a similar result, regardless of what the desires of the public or the state's needs may be at that time. I think this amendment is a solution in search of a problem. We are already required to balance our budget. We also think this constitutional amendment is similar to what has been considered and defeated throughout the country. Since 2004, there have been serious efforts to enact strict spending and revenue limits based on rigid, arbitrary formulas in 25 states, and they have failed every time. These measures are modeled after Colorado's TABOR, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, and by rejecting TABOR, voters in 25 states have helped preserve needed public services. Colorado, the only state to ever adopt TABOR, suffered serious deterioration in education, health care, and other services due to its rigid spending limits. And that is why a coalition of residents, including business leaders, came together to suspend TABOR in 2005. As Minnesota emerges from our current economic crisis, we will need the flexibility to make needed investments in education, health care, roads and bridges, and other areas. If adopted, the TABOR-like limits in the proposed constitutional amendment would prevent our state from making those investments and leave it without the skilled workforce and solid infrastructure needed to prosper. The bottom line is that it's never a good time to adopt rigid, arbitrary limits on our budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mann.
Ms. Chair?
Senator Sundrum.
And not to the witness, but perhaps my understanding is this is not TABOR. And perhaps at some point in time, Senator Colt can explain that to us, either now or later, but in a couple of comments.
Sure. Senator Sundrum, I do, once Senator Colt gets a bill introduced, full well intend to give it a hearing. So I just thought this would be a good opportunity for us to get a little idea of the breadth of it, and so the people, all the people on both sides of it, can get a chance to think about it. We've got big challenges ahead. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question for Ms. Madden, if she's still. Ms. Madden, the last number of months, I think a lot of people who were working in the nonprofit sector have been talking about the general assistance medical care cuts. I was just curious, in your mind, from what you're hearing, they talk about how hospital budgets are going to grow and so on, public hospitals and others are going to grow because of the cuts. I was just curious if you think that that budget cut is going to save us money, just pure economic terms. Is it going to save us more money or cost us more money, or what do you know from it, or don't you have any even way to guess that?
I haven't had a chance to kind of do that analysis on GAMC. I do know at the Council of Nonprofits we are hearing a great number of concerns from our members about how they can maintain services in the face of budget cuts. At the same time, they are also seeing significant reductions in foundation giving, also related to the economy, and for many kinds of services, the need is going up. So we know that our members are really concerned about the ability to continue to provide job training services, healthcare services, child care, the whole range of services that nonprofits provide in our communities in partnership with government. Very concerned about how to maintain those services, and often facing kind of a two-edged impact, where there first is a reduction in spending at the state level and then an impact at the local level, where there often is a fair amount of contracting between local governments and nonprofits, so then a second cut comes later.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Minnesota Budget Project is able to do the numbers or anything, but I just wondered if anybody has, because I just keep hearing from Hennepin County Medical Center, regions, and so on, about the additional costs they have, both from people coming in who were not coming in because they don't have the care ahead of time, people using emergency rooms, and also the uncompensated part of the ones who were coming in already. It sounded to me like just two or three hospitals were going to be spending that much more in effect public money, as much as was going to be saved by the state in the cuts. And I just wondered, because when you factor out statewide, it seems to me we'll be spending a lot more because we didn't prevent the problem. And I was just curious if anybody is looking at that, it would be helpful.
I mean, I think that's the information that people are working to bring forward to the legislature. Clearly, cutting people off of a health care program does not make their health care needs disappear. So whether those folks are going to services in emergency rooms, which is a more expensive way of serving them, or being served in another way. I think those trade-offs is what the legislature will need to evaluate.
Thanks, Ms. Madden. Dane Smith.
Chairman Bach, senators, members of the committee, and staff, we thank you for the opportunity to present information on this proposal and would welcome the chance to provide further information at any time. My name is Dane Smith, and I'm president of Growth and Justice. We're a research organization that focuses on economics and state and local tax and budget policy. We favor smart and ample public investments in human capital and public infrastructure. To simplify, for a bumper sticker, we think taxes are good. And to clarify, we think that taxes do good and absolutely vital things for all of us. We are very active in the realm of improving and redesigning government, reducing costs, putting a new emphasis on accountability. We need to do that. Our governments at the federal level, and particularly in Minnesota, however, have served us well, and our taxes have been remarkably effective in improving our quality of life and maintaining a reasonable equality of life. Now, we can always improve our governments, and there is no better word than accountability to describe what we should expect from them. However, this so-called spending accountability amendment is a profoundly wrong-headed concept, perhaps the worst of the budget alternatives that have been put before this legislature. It would impose a permanent and extreme mechanism that would basically lock in place a failed fiscal orthodoxy, which can properly be called no new public investment, and under which we have been struggling for the last decade. This proposal actually reduces the accountability of the governor and our elected representatives. It would wreak further havoc on our quality of life in Minnesota, exacerbate the growing economic inequality that already is threatening our economy and public safety, and do great damage to our distinctive Minnesota tradition of fairness. And it would be bad for business and taxpayers in the long run. Four very specific points. One, the amendment sets a draconian and absurdly unrealistic bottom line for setting future state and local government budgets, putting a permanent rearview perspective on the price of government. It really would put us in charge of driving our state governments with a rearview mirror only. Price and wage controls never work. This is a price of government control. It's free market enthusiasts who tell us this, and there's common sense there. Two, this amendment violates Minnesota traditions of representative government and deprives our leaders of perhaps the most important overarching decision they make, how much overall to devote to the Commonwealth. Three, this has little or no support from mainstream policy analysts or academic experts on governance or government finance. It doesn't even have the endorsement yet of generally conservative mainstream of our generally conservative mainstream business community in Minnesota. And four, it advances a false premise that our governments, at least in recent years, are taking a larger share of our income and wealth, when in fact the opposite is the case. Nan Madden with the Minnesota Budget Project, I think, accurately described the fact that other states have been refusing this alternative, so I will pass over some remarks that I had prepared on that, but I'd be happy to provide those with you. I think it's really important because the year 1960 keeps being raised here to go back to the year 1960. In a Star Tribune op-ed and on the governor's website, Governor Pawlenty estimates that if this amendment had been in place from 1960 on, we would have spent $22 billion less on state and local government. We keep hearing these references to this year as somehow magical, that it seems to suggest that this year, which is the governor's birth, actually was some sort of fiscal Eden to which we should return. Two really important points about 1960 in the last 50 years. One, as Senator Bach suggests, the figures that are used to describe government growth over this last half century are seriously distorted by the amendment advocates, and do not take into account that we have close to 2 million more people in 2010 than we had in 1960, and that the cost of living and our economy and personal income are enormously larger. Fiscal analyst Jeff Van Wyken at Minnesota 2020 has calculated that the real per capita growth in state general funding has been closer to 3.5% to 5% per year, nowhere close to the 10% claimed by amendment proponents. But let's allow that there was real growth in our public sector between 1960 and 2000. Let's allow that government is in fact bigger, does more things, takes more of our income than it did before the Beatles and the Civil Rights Movement, and before the Twins and the Vikings existed, and before the touchstone phone. Here are things our governments did not do in 1960. We did not pay women in state or local government wages comparable to men, and we made little effort across a broad spectrum to advance economic equality for girls and women. We had no interstate freeway system, very few four-lane highways in Minnesota. We had very unsafe highways, and many or most of our county township roads were unpaved. That's a lot of expense. We essentially did nothing in 1960 to protect our environment. We had no pollution control agency, and our rivers and lakes and groundwater were turning into open sewers. We did not manage our Twin Cities metropolitan area. We provided little or no planning, little or no mass transit, stadium financing in this session might be an unwarranted investment of tax dollars, but we didn't put any money in stadiums back then because we were a minor league state with no major league sports teams. Here's another huge expense. We provided little help to our grandmothers and grandfathers in nursing homes. We did not supplement federal, state, or local Medicare and Medicaid programs because there were no federal programs. We did almost nothing to provide health care for low-income babies and their families. We provided far fewer students. We educated far fewer students, had a much smaller percentage of our population in college. We had a very minimal community college and VOTEC system, all of which we now absolutely need for today's demanding workplace. We did not do anything to help or advance the condition of people who are discriminated against because they happen to be Jewish, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, or American Indians. We shut away and excluded kids with learning disabilities. We did almost nothing for special education. And our mental institutions were, by today's standards, ghoulish, underfunded, and unacceptable. Another huge expense, now versus then, is general K-12 education. We did much less then as a state to equalize education opportunity by regions so that kids in cities with low property wealth had the same shot as kids in wealthy neighborhoods. So, we spent $22 billion more over 50 years, which, by the way, amounts to less than one percentage point of our current total annual personal income in the state of $250 billion. And because, not in spite of this public investment, we are better off in almost every way than we were in 1960. Again, this government spending was accompanied by a rise in average income in Minnesota, and we outperform most every other state on both economic and quality of life rankings and indicators. One final point about growth then and now. The size and the role of the public sector did grow particularly fast between 1960 and 1980. And by the 1990s, our price of government in Minnesota, kept by the finance department at the instigation of the business community in this state, an absolutely reliable figure that measures the actual size of government overall, state and local, this amounted to 17.5% of our income through most of the 90s. We believe this level was about right for our values, and we believe it worked well for us. But in this last decade, without a spending accountability amendment, and largely because one interest group in the state imposed a no new state taxes pledge on a chief executive who never received more than 50% mandate for these policies, we have dangerously downsized our public sector. Our price of government in 2008 is now 15.5%, and on almost every front, our economy and quality of life indicators and rankings are losing ground. In other words, our state and local governments are struggling to do their jobs with about $5 billion less per year than they would have now if the price of government had remained steady. This badly misnamed spending accountability amendment would lock us permanently into this anti-government straitjacket. These kinds of gimmicks typically go under the name Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, but a more appropriate label is a taxpayer's bill of goods. We at Growth and Justice think both the private sector and the public sector should grow apace, that they are of mutual benefit to each other, and that the public, the we, is every bit as important as the private, the me. The enlightened and balanced approach has been a formula for our success in Minnesota, and it would be foolhardy to abandon it. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Smith, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Oh,
Senator Sundrum.
I can't resist. Mr. Smith, obviously you don't like the amendment, but this is not throwing a dart at all. Just, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of growing prosperity in Minnesota? I would suggest we all in this room want the same thing, vibrant and prosperous Minnesota. How do we get there?
Well, Senator Sinjum, I'm glad you've asked, and I wanted to thank you for being a good government advocate who's looking at ways that we can reduce our and be more cost-effective in the way we do things. As you know, Growth and Justice has proposed a Smart Investments in Minnesota Students proposal that would call for investing up to $1 billion more per year. We could find that money from other sources. We think we could start saving it immediately in early childhood and all the things that we absolutely need to do to turn around this state on higher ed attainment. Only about half our kids are graduating from high school. We know that a highly qualified, having the smartest workforce among the states will work for us, and it starts paying off pretty fast. Minnesota proved this in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. That formula worked for us. So we think we need to invest more in education, very rigorously, however, and with a relentless effort to make sure that we're getting results for that money. We need to really attack this good government model that we used to be so proud of in this state. And we think that we can raise this money from income taxes, broadening of the sales taxes. We think we might even cut corporate taxes. We're proud of the business support that Growth and Justice has. We think an overarching, overall income tax reform proposal needs to come forth soon. We encourage that, but we don't think it can be revenue neutral. We think it has to be revenue positive. We're deeply in debt, and we've got new investments that we need to make in this state. We can easily raise $1 billion a year in additional revenue from adjustments on the income tax and sales tax expansion.
Thank you. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sinjum, you know, I've been interested in your questions, and one of the things that occurs to me is, you know, businesses, not just governments, when they're going to grow, they have to make an investment. And they invest in a new process or a new product or a new idea or a new employee or something. And a lot of times it just takes a small amount of investment to make that growth occur. Well, if we put these kind of limits on us, where does that investment money come from for the state? And so, you know, it's a real limiting idea here that would restrict our ability to invest in our young children, because where does the original little bit of money come from to invest in it, in our growth?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, and I'll just be short, you know, we're all victims of our own life experience, but over the last 3 years or so, and I know others in this room do this as well, we go out and talk to our business community in Minnesota, and it's sad to hear, but I'm not sure many, almost everyone that I talk to talk in terms of the fact that Minnesota's tax structure, the cost of business in Minnesota, at least for their particular organizations, is such that they will tend to look outside of the state, in some cases outside of the country, to grow their organizations. So I just think we have to think in terms of our tax structure, the cost of doing business for these organizations. We can give examples after examples of companies that have left our state. We just have to start taking this seriously, and I know, Senator Scoy, you do, and everyone else in this room does as well, but I just think we have to focus on that.
Well, Senator, thank you, and, you know, we're not going to go on with this debate any longer, But, you know, for the examples of businesses that are thinking about leaving the state, there are also examples of businesses that have grown in this state because of the investment we made in our University of Minnesota. I mean, you have to balance all this stuff out because it takes all of that to make it work.
Well, I think, Senator Sundrum, to your comment about companies building overseas, I think what we need to remember is, you know, our Fortune 500 companies that are here in Minnesota are global companies. And, you know, with the industrialization of China and India, those are growing markets for our Minnesota companies. And it makes sense for them to locate facilities, I mean, where the market's growing. And matter of fact, a major Minnesota CEO told me the other day, he said, I was asking about Shanghai, if they had facilities in Shanghai, and he said, if you're going to survive, companies are going to build things in places like Shanghai because that's where the growth is happening. That country is developing, and there's real opportunity there. So I think just because a 3M or an Ecolab or somebody builds a facility in Asia somewhere doesn't mean they're abandoning Minnesota. I think they're addressing a whole new market for themselves also.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, and I mean, remembering back to May, I think with your leadership and this committee's support, we passed a pretty decent tax bill that I think was very pro-business and pro-investment in Minnesota, albeit it had some trade-offs. You know, I understand that, but I think we are just not being honest if we don't think that we have to make those kinds of choices to go forward. Can't just cut our way into prosperity, and that's kind of what I think is being suggested that we do, not by Mr. Smith, but...
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, you started your comments explaining that this bill or this proposal was extreme, mm-hmm. and that it damaged the quality of life in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been here a while, and I've heard the term loosely bantered about quality of life. And I'm beginning to think that people who use those terms kind of define quality of life with a government subsidy in order to promote some type of public good. Sometimes we've used it so much that we don't even think that anything good can come from anywhere else other than a government subsidy. And I was just wondering, you used the term three or four times in your dissertation, and I was just wondering if your definition of quality of life may be different than mine.
I hope not, Senator. We have been around a long time, haven't we? We have seen these phrases bandied about. No, we would not define quality of life by government inputs. We would not define it by the tax rankings. We would define it by the things that are measured in terms of health, wealth, and education attainment. You know, those really are the outputs. And Minnesota has, despite, and again we would say because of its public investment, has done very, very well on all those measures. Longevity, general health, our investments in public health, immunizations, that kind of thing. Really have built good quality, have been an easily demonstrated link towards the outputs. What's interesting is that in the last decade, as a lower tax state, and we have dropped to 20th in taxes as a percent of income, well out of our previous neighborhood, and 30th in total public investments as a percent of income. We are not doing better on the quality of life measures, which are health and welfare and the kinds of things that government tends to watch for, but we're also not doing well on the economic measures compared to other states. We used to be an overachiever economically with income growth rates and job creation that far exceeded other states. So the promised payoff of big income tax cuts and at the federal level, national tax cuts, income tax, as well as capital gains tax cuts, is really difficult to see. We do not see the economic prosperity that was promised from less government and lower taxes. So actually, when you talk to really serious, nonpartisan, ruthlessly non-ideological economists, they will tell you that tax rates are not the most important thing either way. They are marginal. Depends on a whole lot of other factors, sociological, socioeconomic, proximity to markets, rate of technological change, and productivity gains, and that kind of thing. So at the very least, though, we think the argument that being a low-tax, low-government state is going to make things better for all of us is just simply not panning out.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Also, a previous witness also said the same comment that Mr. Smith said, that in other states that have considered a referendum limiting state spending, that it's never passed. Well, then the opponents of this bill should feel rather comforted that the public is on their side and that there would never be a chance of passage in the state of Minnesota.
Very good point, Senator Limmer. Senator Bach, I have no rejoinder to that one.
Yeah.
But it's just be a waste of time, though.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Smith, I'm assuming that those proposals that were passed before were at least 2 years old, if not older, aligning itself with the election years. 2 years ago and back, we do not have the suffering that's going on as a result of our national and state economy as we do now. And yet there still are people, even people in this very room, that are legislators that will be proposing more taxes on the people of Minnesota with the hope of somehow preserving some type of holy grail of government spending to be our saving grace to keep people safe. Government, despite that logic, despite that, it will continue to fail. Because now we are deeply into killing the goose that lays the golden egg, and that is providing good quality jobs for our families. And that is at a tremendous risk now than ever before. I think, you know, being a gambling man, I think I would take the odds that I think the state of Minnesota, the public, who's going through questioning whether they're going to have a job in another month, or whether their pension funds will ever come back, are now looking at the other thing that keeps eroding what's left of their paycheck, what's left of their pension funds, and questioning maybe government should maybe slow down a little bit. And I think they have a right to be in this public discussion.
Well, Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair,
I don't think that's quite a fair characterization of tax policy in Minnesota. And I think you're right. I think there is a perception on the part of the public that taxes keep going up and up and up and up. But all of us at this table know that the income taxes that you paid in 1998 in Minnesota were higher than they are today. Income taxes were higher. Our income tax rates were higher in 1998 than they are today. And I would bet you the general population would not agree with that statement. But we all know that that's true. But I think, I think, Senator Limmer, some of it is perception. I think it's not real.
Well, Mr. Chair, the sales tax is higher now than it was in 1998. Our property taxes are higher than 1998. And so we can't just look at the income tax as a revenue stream for the state of Minnesota, because as we all know, there's many different revenue streams that this body has created to suck more revenue out of the pockets of our taxpayers.
But, Senator Limmer, the price of government, the total price that we pay for state and local government as a percentage of the total income we all earn is lower. I mean, unless somebody wants to dispute the Department of Revenue's numbers, the percentage of our income that we're paying for state and local government is lower today than it was, frankly, when I got elected in 1994.
Well, Mr. Chair, in light of current demographics that are going on now, on the growth of our economy, the growth of government, the proposals that are being talked about in Washington, depending on where that goes, one government program, the health bill. I've seen budget figures that one government program, one vote by Congress, will increase our national debt by 10%. I don't know how we can sustain it when the economic growth of this nation is not growing higher. And maybe we might be a microcosm in Minnesota. I haven't checked the economic growth of our national or our state gross product in relationship to the taxes that we are considering this year. I just don't know how you can sustain it. And I think if we as a legislature cannot stop the growth of government taxation and spending, maybe it's a good time to let the public in on the public discussion and let them decide.
Senator Limmer, if you want to talk about one vote, I think of my parents who were on Medicare. There was one vote in 1965 that created health insurance for everybody once they turned 65. And that was a really expensive vote. But does anybody think we should undo that? That we shouldn't, as a country, be providing health insurance for people when they turn 65? And it was really expensive. Pretty courageous vote on the part of the people in Washington.
Mr. Chairman, we can debate a long time. and we can point out all of the demographics and the economic conditions that were in the background of those votes. This background is far more dire than what they were looking at in 1965.
Senator Limmer, there is no question that the most important thing we can do this legislative session, I think, is try to do something to get this economy moving.
I agree.
I often have said that the deficit is not the problem, it's the symptom. It's the symptom of an economy that's performing really poorly. But everybody talks about the deficit like it's the biggest problem we're facing. And I would argue it's just the symptom of the real problem. I mean, you heard Dr. Stinson said that I think when you figured in the reciprocity change between Minnesota and Wisconsin, that virtually all of our deficit is income tax related. So, I mean, that's the challenge, I think. Is there something we can do? Is there something the governor will agree to do to try and stimulate this economy? And you know, that's not easy. Mr. Smith, thank you.
Senator Bach, Senator Limmer, thank you.
Representative Krenke.
Senator, thank you. Could we have the other? We have some people here from out of town, so
you
can hear from me anytime. But they flew in especially to be here for the
Kelly hearing. Cobb and Josh Culling. Is that okay?
Should we go ahead?
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kelly Cobb. I serve as a state affairs manager at Americans for Tax Reform. I needn't go over the depressing news earlier today before this hearing began, but I think it goes without saying that Minnesota needs to reform the way it does business. And it's in prioritizing its expenditures and reforming its tax code. I come here in support of this amendment, of the governor's amendment. I think it's a great step forward in restoring Minnesota's fiscal and economic health. Ideally, and I think that's the conversation we're having today, state spending should match tax revenue. Tax collection correlates greatly with economic growth. State coffers get fatter during good years and leaner during bad years. Yet spending growth tends to rise faster during years of economic downturn, resulting in tax revenue being overspent. This leads to calls for higher taxes or spending cuts, the likes of which we saw this year, and it too often comes in the middle of a recession. In 2000, for example, Minnesota's state gross product, or GSP, was grew by 5%, while spending increased by 4.86%. This meant that the expenditure baseline could generally be sustained by the economy. In 2001, as the recession hit, for example, spending jumped to 12%, while the economy grew by only 0.7%. So this caused large budget gaps that year and years that followed. This massive hike in total expenditures in 2001 pushed the spending baseline beyond state gross product. And even as GSP began to decline in 2004 leading up to the current recession, Minnesota continued to increase total spending, resulting in more shortfalls. In 2006, before the recession even began, total expenditures, which include both the general fund and all capital expenditures, so everything, had hit 4.9% growth, while GSP tumbled to a mere 0.5%. I think we can all agree that's pretty unsustainable. Looking at it another way, and I believe that you might have my testimony in front of you, there's a chart that might be helpful. In 1999, spending and GSP growth chained to 1989 levels were at 65% and 63% respectively, so virtually on par. The state spent as much as it continued to grow as an economy. In 2008, just a decade later now, chained state spending is at 117%, while gross state product is only at 84%. It's an economy that can't handle the amount of money that's being spent. Simply put, growth in Minnesota spending, well above the state's economic growth, is completely unsustainable. Governor Pawlenty's spending accountability amendment will tie spending growth to tax revenue and the economy, helping to prevent the sort of budget gaps we saw earlier this year, while simultaneously protecting taxpayers from shouldering a larger burden of government. Compare these numbers with Colorado, which constitutionally limits spending to population plus inflation growth, an idea which you seem to express support before, but which some of the other folks who have testified are adamantly against, mostly because it works. Spending cap was enacted by the voters in 1992, and it's currently the strongest tax and expenditure limit in the nation. Chained to 1989 levels, just like I mentioned for Minnesota, spending in Colorado has grown by 132%. Now, that's more than Minnesota, but the economy has grown by the exact same amount. You see, spending restraint has allowed Colorado expenditures to grow just at a slightly more sustainable pace, while also maintaining a lower tax rate structure with higher incomes and stronger economic growth. That's the point. A couple comments on higher spending versus lower taxes. I know they were brought up by some folks earlier who called into question the value of higher taxes in an economy. Minnesota's balanced budget requirement means higher spending is typically followed by higher taxes. It's Minnesota actually has the 12th highest, not the 20th highest, the 12th highest state and local tax burden in the nation. It has the third highest business tax, not only in the United States, but when combined with the federal rate in the entire developed world, the third highest business tax in the developed world. Furthermore, a recent comprehensive study on economic research by a number of economists from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco found that a dollar of spending, government spending, results in 70 cents of job-creating activity, so the multiplier effect, 70 cents on a dollar. However, a dollar in tax cuts results in $1.30 to $3 of job-creating activity. So if you take the numbers provided by the governor's office, that's $22 billion that could have been saved. That's $22 billion that could have been put in the private economy to realize this type of job-creating activity and economic growth. Now, I'd also like to add that this is not a partisan issue, but the main numbers that came from this study in the Federal Reserve Bank from San Francisco were provided by an economist in 2007 named Christina Romer. Christina Romer is now President Obama's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. So these aren't debatable numbers. This is just facts of multiplier effects of spending versus tax cuts. I'd just like to add that I think true governing means prioritizing spending, not just simply continuing to raise taxes to cover unsustainable spending habits. I think this amendment does exactly that. And just as a family cannot spend frivolously and assume a pay raise will come naturally to cover it, neither should the state. Just as a family or a business cuts back their budget during an economic downturn, I think so should the state. And I think you may not agree on whether or not this should be put on the ballot or a similar version or some sort of constitutional spending limitation, but I think it would be right to give it to your residents, to give it to your constituents, to put on the ballot for them to vote on. After all, they're the ones who are going to be paying for this. And I did notice, just as a side comment, as I was standing in the back, if you're looking for places to cut, you have to start small. And I noticed around the room there are these nice little light bulbs in the center of the room. Those are classic Edison bulbs. They're a specialty bulb. They're incredibly inefficient, and they cost about $9 a bulb on wholesale prices. So I think you could probably start there, start small, look for places to cut back in spending, and I think you can find there's a lot more there that you maybe didn't see that might have been right in front of you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mr. Cobb, you are absolutely reinforcing my observation as I've been traveling around the state. People are looking for simple solutions.
There you go.
To very complex problems, and light bulbs are probably a... Let's just not lead anybody to believe we can solve the problems with that. That's all. But thank you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Culling?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Joshua Culling. I am State Government Affairs Manager at the National Taxpayers Union. We are the nation's oldest taxpayer advocacy organization. We have about 362,000 members across the country, including about 7,300 here in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity today to offer NTU support on behalf of our members of Governor Pawlenty's Spending Accountability Amendment. Now, you may have a copy of my prepared remarks in front of you. Just for the sake of time, I'll jump around a little bit and leave the full text for you to read at your own time. I just want to touch on a few major points. First of all, I just want to debunk maybe some of the things that we've heard earlier today about where Minnesota stands as far as its tax climate relative to other states. I'd also like to clear some things up about Colorado's Tabor initiative, which, while it's quite different from what we're looking at today, it still tells a pretty good story of the purpose of tax and expenditure limitations and the outcomes. And I would also like to underscore the fact that tax expenditure limitations have passed the vote of the people multiple times in recent history in this country, and I'll give some specific examples. First of all, on the point that Minnesota's tax burden has come down since 1998, Mr. Chair, that is actually true, but that doesn't that ignores the fact that Minnesota still is on net a high tax state. Minnesotans pay 10.2% of their income every year to state and local government. That's the 12th highest in the country and about half a percentage higher than the national average. So while the tax burden has come down a little bit, it's been a marginal decrease in what Minnesotans pay to the government, and it's still a little bit too high, and that, of course, is fueled by the spending numbers that some people before me have talked about. Second, I'd like to talk just briefly about Colorado, and that's a part of my prepared testimony that I'll read briefly as well. Colorado, as Kelly mentioned, has the nation's strongest tax and expenditure limitation, Tabor, which passed in 1992. Tabor restricts the annual growth of government to the rates of inflation plus population growth. It allows the public to vote on any new taxes or the increase of existing taxes, and it refunds surplus revenue directly to the taxpayer. While it's different from the current proposal in Minnesota, like I said, Tabor kind of offers an example of how a constitutional limit on state spending can foster a climate of economic growth. And as Kelly mentioned again, to be sure, state government spending continues to grow annually in Colorado. It just does so at a responsible and a predictable rate. The result has been a phenomenal private sector growth and prosperity. Personal income in Colorado has tripled, or did triple, between 1990 and 2008, and population grew by 49%. Now, much of that population growth can be directly attributed to the growth of the private sector, which is the true source of job creation. The private sector in Colorado constitutes 77% of the state's economy. That's an important number because, as I mentioned, job growth and sustainable job growth comes from the private sector, and that share of Colorado's economy is fifth highest in the nation. I can't underscore. I think that's the most important statistic to be attributed to Tabor in Colorado. But in my testimony, I say perhaps most importantly, but I'm now going to say second most importantly. Colorado has seen its tax rates fall dramatically since the implementation of Tabor. The state sales tax is now the second lowest in the nation at 2.9% compared with Minnesota's 6.875% rate. Personal and corporate income taxes have fallen to a flat rate of 4.63% compared to income at 7.85% and corporate at a flat 9.8% rate here in Minnesota. By moderating the growth of government and allowing the private sector to hold on to more of its income, Colorado has encouraged investment, job creation, and economic growth. Now, I just wanted to refute a couple things that we heard earlier about the negative impacts of Tabor. Someone before me correctly noted that Colorado state government doesn't spend much on public education. That's true. The number that I've seen is fourth lowest per pupil on public education in the country.
What that ignores is that's not how we accurately evaluate public education. The way that we the way that we should evaluate public education is the outcome, not what we put in, but what we get out. Since the implementation of Tabor in Colorado, more students go to college. There are higher graduation rates. They have above-average national test scores at the elementary school level in math and science. And as I mentioned, tax rates have fallen throughout all of that. More people are coming, are migrating in terms of net domestic migration. That is taking out people who have immigrated to this country and who have been born, just people who already existed moving around the country. Colorado is attracting a lot more people because there are more jobs. It's also a beautiful place to visit. And if you listen to some detractors of Tabor and their descriptions that they make it sound like people are being wheeled around to the hospital in wheelbarrows and being denied education, and there's garbage everywhere. In fact, Denver is one of the most beautiful cities in the country, and the entire state really has flourished as a result of Tabor. My last point is that tax and expenditure limitations such as this in a variety of different forms have passed in this country multiple times, going back to 1979, Proposition 13, which is quite different, but it is a limit on the growth of government, passed in California. Tabor obviously passed in 1992 and then was defended in 2008 by a 10-point margin, despite public employee unions and other unions spending millions and millions of dollars to essentially knock out Tabor. Coloradans went to the ballot box and resoundingly let people know that they appreciate what it's done for the state. And then there was a version of Tabor just this past month on the local level in Manchester, New Hampshire, that passed and will do the same things for Manchester that Tabor has done for Colorado and that a version could do here in Minnesota. So with that, I'll conclude, and I'll just say that, you know, as Minnesota families tighten their belts, I think it'd be unfair for government to suggest that it should not at least consider doing the same, or at least allowing the people to decide whether government should do the same. At the very least, I think voters should be given an opportunity for an up or down vote on Governor Polenyi's proposed constitutional amendment. Again, on behalf of our 7,300 members here in Minnesota, I would urge you to consider and ultimately pass this bill and take a stand for the heavily burdened taxpayers of your state. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'm pleased to answer any questions.
Senator Marty, question?
Mr. Chair, I think more a comment about both the last two witnesses said something about families tightening their belts, and Mr. Cobb says, just as a family cannot spend frivolously. I think that's true, but I think most families, if they had the sickest people in their family hurting, they wouldn't cut off their health care for them. They would find a way to do it. And the governor's proposal this last year, his action to balance the budget was to cut the sickest 31,000 people off of their health care. And I just don't see how that is frivolous. And I don't think a family calls it frivolous either. I just, the families I know don't see that as frivolous.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I agree with you. But I think it's important to note that the first thing that when we talk about that's going to get cut in a budget, we're going to cut health care, we're going to cut unemployment benefits or something like that, the first thing means that that's the lowest priority for the state. When you create a list of everything the state does and you go, well, we have to save money, so you cross one out, that means it's the lowest priority. Now, not to say that's the governor's opinion on the matter, but the fact of the matter is it means that that's a lower priority than these silly little light bulbs above me. And that's the thing that's disturbing to me. So when I say frivolous, I don't mean that it's unimportant or anything like that. I'm not saying that health care, for example, or something like that is unimportant. But what I am saying is that there are things that the state is spending money on which aren't important and they don't get talked about. And that's where the state can come in and save money to ensure that services that are needed, that people do see as important, are met, not the things that we talk about day to day, but actually become the first thing we cut as the lowest priority. Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I think it is clear that's what the governor thinks is the lowest priority. And those light bulbs, which I'm sure Historical Society are the ones who want us to do that, the governor could find ways to prioritize other things if he thinks the sickest people in the state don't need health care. is if he thinks they do need health care and he doesn't have the money, he could cut some other things. And, yeah, I think every one of us here would have things that we would point out are the things. When Governor spent $500,000 on PR for the new 35W bridge to say how great we're doing on it, I think that's one I wouldn't have had in there. I think there are lots of ideas of things that I might consider frivolous or you might consider frivolous, but the governor, the one who is pushing this amendment, because we've got frivolous spending, he's the one who took the 31,000 sickest people and said, forget the health care. And it's going to cost us more because of that.
Representative Creakey, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Chair Bach. I believe the last time I was in this room, it was a little different configuration. By the way, in 2006, remind senators that they voted unanimously to support my tax reduction bill. So thank you once again for that 2006 vote. Let me just, if I might, intervene a moment here and talk about the comment that Senator Marty, why I believe this amendment is important to the citizens of the state of Minnesota is first and foremost that my college economics professor, one of the few things I still remember from college, and for those co-alums in the room, that was Dr. Bill Spellman, said that the propensity to spend always exceeds the propensity to save. And I think we all know this. We all have learned this over our life lesson. And if you don't believe it, all you have to do is go to Target, Walmart, or any store to see what's happening in this pre-Christmas era. But the point is, when faced with the realities of the budget last year, this legislature faced a $6.4 billion shortfall. Okay, and what was the outcome? Okay, the final outcome was that 41% of that budget shortfall, and to balance the budget, was met with one-time federal stimulus money. 42% of it was based on allotments of the governor. And Senator Marty, I don't necessarily concur or agree with how the governor did it, but the point is, in order to balance the budget, that's what the governor chose to do. 6% of the budget was line item vetoes by the governor, and the legislature did its heavy lifting of 11% in terms of budget reductions and reallocations of dollars. So, again, folks, I've been in the same seat that you're in. It is always difficult to prioritize. It is always difficult to make the tough decisions as to whether it is either going to raise revenue or reduce expenditures. Senator Bach, I applaud your willingness to look at this issue. There will be much more debate. And obviously, to tell you both Senator Bach and Senator Marty, I don't know why anyone would want to be governor come January 2011, but I applaud you for stepping up and wanting to take on the challenge. The challenges that we face in the state are enormous, and it's going to take heavy lifting on everyone's part to better Minnesota and to better the future for all citizens.
Representative Creakey, one comment, I think, on the governor's actions were 42% through unallotment. The majority of that was an accounting shift by the school payment shift. So one time, not very heavy lifting, I would argue. Just to set the record straight, I think, that the governor did not unallot 42%. The lion's share of that was just an accounting shift.
Senator Bach, I concur, and I understand the situation. And again, we in the past, when the legislature has faced these difficult decisions, we have resorted to accounting shifts in order to balance the budget. And again, I would look at this amendment in the context of, let's say, a family situation. How many families, how many people have faced a foreclosure action, or coming close to foreclosure, or even having a very difficult time making their mortgage payments because they walked off that cliff called an adjustable rate mortgage? They banked in the future that there was going to be an increase in revenue. They were going to get that salary increase. They were going to get that bonus. They were going to have revenues in the future to pay that mortgage, which did not come to fruition. And therefore they face a very, very challenging, difficult time. And I think, again, it's a proposal that merits further discussion and further debate. It's not an end-all or be-all solution. It is not going to do anything to solve the budget situation that the legislature faces in 2010 or even into 2011, 2012. But, as I said, it is, I think, a tool by which the legislature can help control the appetite for spending because, again, I've seen Republicans as well as Democrats advocate for higher spending yet don't match on the other side the propensity to tax, plain and simple.
Well said, Representative Krenke. There's 10 spending committees upstairs.
And there's only one revenue-raising
committee. It's much easier to spend money than to raise it.
Absolutely.
And that's true in everybody's lives, I guess, not just here at the Capitol. Anything else, members? Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the proposal, I'd like to say it just makes common sense. I don't like the references to Tabor because what I understand is not that restrictive. It's a work in progress. It's as Representative Kirky said, it's a tool. But I also heard Senator Limmer say I'm a betting man. And I'm going to offer a revenue tool, which I've done here before. And that is Racino. We'd have $1 billion in revenue this session. So let me put that on the table. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
You know,
I'm a betting man when odds are in my favor.
You know, this committee, members, this committee is going to have one heck of a good discussion if that Racino bill ever gets here. You know, it's got a couple other hurdles to get through. I think this will be the last place it stops before it goes to the floor. So if we ever get it here, we're going to have a pretty – we keep talking about it, but we've never actually had the chance to, I think, have it at the table. But maybe this year we will.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
I did offer an amendment last session. We did have it at the table.
Yeah, but that's not like having the bill
the
in front
actual
of
bill.
Okay. No, where we can line up testimony and hear the pros and cons and you're acting like a ranger now. You're just offering it. Any other questions of Representative Krenke or the out-of-state testifiers? Thank you for coming down, and we will be having another hearing and more discussion on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
We've got one more person who's asked to testify, Lucia Polagas. How bad was my...
Lisa, actually.
Okay.
Thank you for your time, by the way. This is my daughter, Cheyenne, who's very tired.
Sit. We need to have you sit down, give your name and who you represent for the record, and your daughter's if she's going to say something.
She might just be too tired to say something. I'm not sure. My name is Lisa Polakis, and I am a very disappointed and frustrated constituent of Michelle Bachmann. I would like to oppose the constitutional amendment. Obviously, I'm speaking not in favor of it. It isn't a diet for state government, as Commissioner Hansen stated. It's going to force more cost shifts to working families who are already struggling. Many, many families that are already struggling. For an example, enrollment is supposedly down in the Anoka-Hennepin School District, yet an average third grade class is 30 students. My daughter's, for example, is 33 students with one teacher. The cost shifts to the state, I'm sorry, the cost shifts that have come down on the district, the locals, the county governments, have just forced everybody else to shift it down the line. Our property taxes have gone from $840 to as high as $2,400, with the bulk of that increase being in the last 4 years. Our school busing has now gone from a one-mile radius to a two-mile radius. This is the biggest for me, I think. With that change, we are a tenth of a mile under 2 miles away from the school, which means I either pay the daycare plus the busing service, or my daughter is a walker. And there are so many other families in the Anoka-Hennepin School District that are in this same situation and in other school districts across the state. Her two routes that she can walk for school, one would be a path through Alpine Park in the woods, which is not plowed in the winter, has two level three sex offenders within a mile, one, two blocks away from this path. The other one is not a path, but it's the other route that she could take, is along Alpine Drive, which is a 50-mile-per-hour road. The path doesn't start until later on in the park. Obviously, I do not have her walking to school. I have considered other options, and I've gone with them, but there are so many other families that do not have that option at all. Our local budget has been forced to slash their funding, I think eliminate their funding, to the community education program, dropping from 40 classes a year to 10. And this is all from cost shifts, from all the budget cuts coming down to the counties, then to the locals, then being passed on to the people that can't afford it most. Our wages have remained stagnant while everything else has increased, such as insurance, groceries, gas. We need to invest in public service by asking the wealthiest Minnesotans to pay their fair share of taxes. Senator Limmer, you asked how we can sustain it by investing in Minnesota, investing in our future. Nobody ever gained everything by cutting everything. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Let me just, I know there it is very popular to tax the wealthy. I'm aware of that. I hear that out on the campaign trail. I think what we all need to understand, though, is there are not enough of them to solve these enormous budget challenges that the state of Minnesota has. I heard one of the candidates say that they were going to tax people with over $500,000 in income. Well, you know what? Probably aren't many of us in this room. But there's only 21,000 of those people in the entire state out of 2.4 million tax returns. There are not enough wealthy people in Minnesota to solve this problem. We all, as one community, are going to have to figure this out. And it's a pretty daunting challenge in front of us.
Understandable, Chairman. And there are going to be so many different ways that are going to be looked at to solve this problem. And no one way is going to be the only way to do it. There are going to be multiple ways and any combination of ways. But the state could raise $3.8 billion to help with this budget situation if the wealthiest 10% of Minnesotans that are couples earning over $150,000 a year paid their fair share in taxes.
I know that's one of the lines on
the
campaign trail.
That's not the $500,000.
You just need to understand what the top 10% is. I think that comes down to about $120,000 in household income. I personally don't think a family making $120,000 is wealthy, but apparently other people do. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I hear your points and I hear the witnesses' points. I would say, though, that if we went our tax brackets up, including some at the lower end, she ended up paying an extra $30, $40, $50 a year, and her daughter didn't have to walk or she have to find an alternative system of transportation. I say that'd be a very good deal. And I think that the point is that, yes, you're not going to get it all from the top 2% or even top 10%, but you could change things with a little bit more from a lot more people and a significant amount more from the top end. You could address some of those needs and save money in the long run.
This, and Senator Marty, as you well know, this committee tried to do that last year. We passed a pretty good tax bill, and it did have a fourth tier on the income tax, a more progressive one than the House proposed, at a lower income bracket, at a higher rate than the House proposed. So I do support a progressive income tax. I just want
right.
to caution the witness
yes.
that we are all going to have to help with this.
Oh, yes.
And we just need to be careful that we don't somehow lead people to believe that if those rich people just paid more, all this problem would go away because there just aren't enough of them.
No, but
that is not to say I do not support an upper tier on the income tax, because clearly I do, or we wouldn't have passed one here last year, I don't think.
As Senator Marty said, I would most certainly be willing to pay more if I saw the benefits from it versus more cuts and more cuts and more cuts.
Now your testimony is improving.
I would. That's not even a question. If it meant that it would hurt less people, if it would not hurt the kids or the kids that have one-parent incomes, people laid off, you know, hours being cut, they're hearing it at home from the stress on their families. They're hearing it at school because of the cuts to the schools. They're hearing it everywhere, and they're the ones that are the most hurt by it.
Would your daughter like to testify as long as she came all the way down here?
Would you like to say anything?
I wouldn't pass up this chance if I was you. Somebody's going to ask in school tomorrow.
Did you testify?
Why don't you at least give us your name and what city you live in and what school you go to so that we can put it on our tape recorder?
My name is Cheyenne, and I live in City of Ramsey, and I go to Ramsey Elementary.
Thank you. Welcome.
And I'm in third grade.
Welcome to the state capitol. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Members, anything else? We're going to meet again on Thursday. We're invited at 2 o'clock, I believe. So this committee's adjourned until Thursday, December 10th, 2 p.m.